very good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, employers defaulting on payment of workers' social security contributions. How many more will go to prison? Internal strife in opposition NPP. Could it pose problems for the party's preparations towards next general elections? National Service Secretariat to the rescue of service personnel as postings begin. And Black Stars pursue another World Cup dream. But first, they have to brush aside the pharaohs of Egypt. Join me in the next hour as we discuss these issues. You can also join the discussions via text on 0266-677570. 0266-677570. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. There may be several Ghanaian workers who, after retiring from active service, look back on their life and regret what they did right or wrong and curse themselves for certain decisions. One of those decisions is looking unreservedly while your employer fails to honor your security contributions, which could guarantee you some survival while you take a rest to reflect on your 60 years of service. In several institutions today, our employers who are not paying their workers' contributions and warnings upon warnings have gone unheeded. At the weekend, a circuit court in Accra sentenced 2004 CPP presidential candidate and chief executive officer of Gokra Security Limited, George Agude, to 3 months in prison for failing to pay the social security contribution of his employees. This, according to SNIT, is after a long running battle with Mr. Agude. So why did it take SNIT this long to get Mr. Agude to pay up? And what happens to all the contributions that have not been paid in the past? Let's get some answers from Ms. Eva Megashi, Director of SNIT Corporate Affairs in Accra. Good evening, Eva, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening.
Well, your outfit has succeeded in obtaining a judgment against the CEO of Gokra Security Limited, and we understand the battle was a long-running one. Why was he hesitant to pay his workers' contributions?
Well, under a 766, every employer is obliged to make sure or ensure that all his workers are registered with the Social Security scheme, and the Social Security contributions are deducted from the worker's salary, and the employer is also expected to add his portion of 13% and pay this money to SNIT. With the issue of Goldcrest, this is a protracted one. We've been going back and forth for so many years. And when we make negotiations, we agree on something, then he will renege on whatever he's supposed to do. But SNIT does not take pleasure in taking employers to court. But before you see a SNIT taking an employer to court, it means that the person has been either a recalcitrant employer or there have been difficulties. We always insist or tell employers to come to SNIT when they have any problem. We can discuss and negotiate for the terms of payment. Some of them, they renege on the negotiations, and they renegotiate, and they renege again. It's back and forth for so long.
But in his case, why was he hesitant to pay his workers' contribution? What reasons did he give?
Well, for an employer, he can give various reasons. Sometimes he wouldn't even register all the workers. He would register some of them and leave some of them. And we have intelligence, or we have our compliance officers who are supposed to comb the establishment, and they are mandated to enter the premises of the employer and go through their books to see whether all the workers there have been registered and then they have social security numbers. So with him, he could have given so many reasons, but whatever the reasons, it does not give you the mandate to renege on the payment of social security contributions. You can always come to us, and we will always negotiate with you.
And all this while, you said that the battle was a long-running one, and all those years he refused to pay. What did SNIT do? Were you waiting for the courts to act?
No, when you default, if few days The deadline is 14th of the ensuing month. Immediately after that, it starts accruing interest. It's a penalty, a 3% penalty. So it's a, since it's a compound interest, you know, you add the interest to the principal, it's accruing interest. So far as the money remains unpaid, it's accruing interest. So if he's being convicted, the conviction does not cancel the indebtedness. The indebtedness is there, it has accrued interest, and the conviction too will also stand.
So now, when he goes to jail, does it settle the matter? What happens to all the arrears?
He's going to pay. The jail, that's why I said that the jail, the conviction does not cancel the indebtedness. The indebtedness, so he'll come and settle the bill.
He'll come and settle all those arrears.
Exactly.
But then, I believe, but some of his workers might have retired without anything.
Please come again.
I'm saying some of his workers might have retired without anything.
Well, no, he will pay. He's going to pay. He will pay the money. The money will be paid.
Even all those who are at home without anything, he will still come back from jail and settle those arrears.
Yes, he's going for 3 months, so come and settle. Now it's between the court and him and his company.
So how then do you locate all those employees who are retired?
We don't. The employees, when they retire, they apply for their benefits. When you retire, you apply for the benefits. There are certain documents that you have to complete. You apply, we process, and we pay you. You go to the bank, and we pay you. When you are 72 years and above, we want to ensure that you are still alive and you are paying. So then you complete a life certificate. But even we are going off that. We are trying to extend it. Instead of every 6 months, you come and complete a life certificate. SNIT is all trying to bring out a modality so that it will be about 3 years before you come and complete the life certificate. But in the interim, we are going by the life certificate. But we'll have some interventions to check and ensure that the person that we are paying is alive and is collecting the money until 3 years when you are required to come and complete another life certificate.
Well, Eva, there are several institutions, I believe, both state or government and private entities who are in Mr. Gude's shoes. Are you aware of all of them?
It might interest you to know that for the past 11 weeks, we have been publishing the names of defaulting employers. 11 weeks. Every week, 25. It appears on Monday and on Thursday, even today. Yeah, we have published the names of defaulting employers. As at July this year, new defaulting employers, over 1,700, we have prosecuted them in court. As at June this year, only this year, excluding last year. So it's something that we've been doing. But some of the employers, when they default, they come and negotiate in any of the branches, the nearest branch where they pay their contribution, and they pay with penalty. The minute you default, you start paying penalty. But they come, they pay, and nobody hears it. It's only those who refuse to pay, they go to court.
So if you can use the courts to get the workers' contribution to SNIT, why don't you pursue that line of action strongly? Else we'll continue to have this long-running hide-and-seek.
We don't enjoy imprisoning employers. Because if you do that, you jeopardize the future of the workers. So it's a last resort, but we like to encourage employers that when they have problems, they come to SNIT, they go to the branch manager, discuss with them, we give a human face to them, and for them to pay, negotiate and pay. But when you negotiate, like you make an agreement and refuse to pay, or you refuse to go by the agreement, then that's where you go, we take you to court. We don't enjoy taking employers to court, no. But we want to encourage them that when they have problems, even when you change location, the law says that you have to inform the director general. When you change the name of your company, you have to inform us. When your workers, they stop working, you have to inform us. These are the obligations of the employer.
Talking about the workers, why do we have workers in these organizations, some very learned and enlightened, yet keep quiet when all these illegalities are being perpetrated against them?
Sometimes they are afraid of victimization. But we are saying that our doors are open. They can call us and in anonymity. They give us the name of the employer, the location, the address, and then the name of the managing director and the telephone number. And we'll do the follow-up.
Well, even more serious now is the problem of expatriates with business here and employing locals for their companies, but are refusing to pay out their SNIT contributions. And we understand some eventually escape to their countries without paying these contributions.
There is a law on the expatriate contributions. When you have a similar social security, you know, sometimes they come on contract 2 years, 1 year. If they have a similar form of social security in their country where they are coming, and there should be evidence, then they are not obliged to pay here for the foreigners because they can't become on contract 6 months or something. But it's something that we are still negotiating, we are still in discussion, whether expatriates pay or they don't pay, and then at what time they stop paying, they should stop paying.
So what advice do you have for employers in general, and then workers as well?
Well, I would like to advise all employers that it is their obligation to ensure that they pay the social security contributions for their workers. It's an offense under section between sections 83 and 86 of Act 766 that they have to pay the contributions. If they default, they pay penalty. And as a last resort, they can go to prison. So whatever it is, when they have a problem, they should come to us. But first, they should ensure that they pay the contributions of their workers. And to the workers, they should also ensure that the employers are paying. The workers, the identifiable groups in the organization, the senior staff, the local union, they should also ensure that the employers are paying so that they don't wait when they're about to disengage, they find out their social security contributions have not been paid.
Eva, are you currently prosecuting any defaulting person apart from Ms. Agude?
I think I've mentioned that we have been printing the names of defaulting employees and even employers. And even we indicate those whose cases are in court. So if you like, you can go and check today's papers. We have asterisks on those whose cases are in court. And I've mentioned that this year, as of July, we have prosecuted over 1,700 new cases in court as of July this year alone. So it's something that is not Mr. Agude as a person or as an individual. It's an ongoing thing.
So we should expect more imprisonment?
Well, we have to. We don't enjoy it, but if we have to.
All right, Eva, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you, too.
Eva Megashi is Director of SNIT Corporate Affairs in Accra. Now, let's look at the political dimensions of this case, because Mr. Agude also doubled as a politician and stood as a presidential candidate on the ticket of the CPP in 2004. Dr. Evans Agridako is a lecturer in political science at the University of Ghana, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Doc, and welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening. Thank you for having me.
Well, Doc, Mr. Agude is a politician who also became a presidential candidate of the Asantefo's original party. How was he allowed to stand if he had all these problems? And didn't the party and the country know this?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think that fundamentally, we as a nation must be very much interested in how people make their money. Unfortunately, we operate in a system where I think that what we are interested in is whether people have money or not. And how they make their money, I think we are not interested. You see, that creates an incentive for all sorts of things. You know, as we move on, in other jurisdictions, as they normally say, you can run but you can hide. The system will catch up with you. And I think that is what we are beginning to see now. Of course, as the Senate indicated, it's an ongoing process. But if this happens to be one of the big things, you know, in our system, Now, what it means is that due diligence, we have to take due diligence, you know, seriously. It's important that we do proper backgrounding. The Constitution itself spells out in clear and unambiguous terms who qualifies to contest what positions among others. But of course, if you don't have the evidence against somebody, I mean, if there's somebody moral turpitude, etc., you can't really use those things against them. But for me, what we do, how do we ensure, or what proper backgrounding do we do, or what is the nature of backgrounding do we do, for instance, before we pass people, you know, to contest very important positions in this country. And now, fundamentally, as individuals, as citizens within the state, it is important that we fulfill our obligations to the state. It is not always right for us to expect the state to perform, but we as individuals are not prepared to fulfill our obligations under the contract that we signed with the state. Now, if we see the state, the relationship between the state and you and I, the citizens, the employees, the employers, among others, all the key actors in the state, as a social contract, then you unpack this social contract, and the conclusion that you draw is that all the key actors have obligations under the contract. And so we must not renege on our contract, as it were. And if you think, what it will mean is that we will be making the society dry, we will be undermining the very policies that, you know, we have put in place, either passively or implicitly put in place, through our representative, through governments, among others. And at the end of the day, we'll be shortchanging the state in the process. So I think that it behooves on all of us that, look, we need to tighten up. We need to begin to bite law, not just by enactment, by enforcement, very important. Otherwise, it is not being enforced, useless. So all these things indicate that we would need constantly to do some proper background checks on key, you know, personalities who want to, you know, occupy very sensitive positions in this country. And I think that when we begin to do that properly, we will be serving, producing role models who are going to be very effective leaders of this, you know, country. Yes. Very success of our country.
Well, Doc, if I understand you perfectly, you are saying that the people should demand and look out for all these before people are allowed to stand for public office or even engage in politics.
Come again, who do you want to candidate?
I was saying that if I understand you perfectly, you are saying that the people should demand and look out for all these before people are allowed to stand for public office or even engage in politics.
Yeah, we know that people, there is very little that the people, I mean, as masses, we can do. That is why we tax certain institutions. The EC, for instance, what do? I mean, with regards to background checks of individuals, if somebody is filing nominations for, you know, presidential candidature or whatever, the various political parties themselves, what do they do? Screening processes, at the end of the day, will ensure, I mean, if they are rigorous and they are thorough and not informed by what I would refer to as lazy thinking, then there's a need for these institutions to tighten up the screening processes so that at least we can get people with very high moral standing, people who have seriously fulfilled their obligation to the state and to their citizens and to their employees, among others, people who are prepared, who have some track record of good service to this nation, people who have indicated, proven beyond reasonable doubt that they can be trusted, among others. So this is a collective responsibility, and I would touch not just the citizens, but key institutions of state. You know, the state exists for its people. Government exists for its people. And because you and I are sometimes powerless, and perhaps we don't have the capacity and we don't have the will not be well positioned to do this proper check. That is why the state has put in place certain key institutions to actually act on our behalf. And that is why Senate, for instance, is there. And if you look at it critically, but for this Act 766 of 2008, which even empowered Senate to really go to court and seek a refund or the payment of defaulting, you know, employers, among others, You can imagine what is going to happen to the rank and file, to the people, to workers in this country. So it is a responsibility of the state fundamentally to ensure that the key institutions, which I would refer to as regulatory institutions, do their work properly so that the citizens can benefit. Because there are certain things that you and I cannot do. We don't have the capacity to do that. But the state has, can use all its apparatus to look at all these, you know, areas of infractions, and then, of course, the citizens' interests at the end of the day are protected and safeguarded, yes.
But look, some people are already dismissing this line of interrogation because they claim politicians are all the same and they all have one baggage or another, probably why they will not question this even if it comes to their attention.
But that would be a defensive approach to take. You see, we have always indicated that the price we pay, for instance, for not participating in government is to live under full government. I mean, if you decide to keep quiet, you know, things will happen. I mean, we will definitely will run this country down. The argument that we are all the same, for me, doesn't really wash. It's like we think that we are certain, throwing our hands in despair and hoping against hope that nothing can really be done. That is not the case. You see, the fundamental point about human nature is that human beings naturally will want lines of least resistance. Lines of least resistance. You can imagine, even in organizational settings, I mean, if there are not strict laws about when you should report to work and what your code of conduct, what your behavior, how your attitude towards employees or customers must be, among others, human beings, you allow them that latitude, nothing will work. You understand? Very few people will want to go by strict laws. But because the laws exist and because there are sanctions or rewards for compliance or non-compliance, people will comply. So what we need as a people, I mean, if you look at other established democracies, it's about laws. It's about enforcement of the laws, you see, so that we all will submit to the laws. And then once we all submit to the laws, those who refuse to abide by the laws will be taken to task. That is what is happening. That is what Senate is doing. People know that this is a social protection policy, very important for all of us. At old age, whether through, I mean, even your old age, you can be sickness or death, you know, several other, you know, factors that will lead to loss of revenue, for instance. So if the state cannot guarantee some decent retirement packages through some enactment of some of these critical social, you know, protection policies or, you understand, programs, what will happen is that the state then will have to have another responsibility of taking care of people when they go on retirement. That will be an irresponsible state. So it means that we need, all of us collectively must submit to a set of laws, and institutions must be empowered. We must be dealing with a lot of education must go on. There will definitely be defaulters. Why not? All over the world. People who decide to, you know, use the system, sometimes they want to milk the system dry. Some people decide to take advantage of loopholes which exist in the system, so they can make, you know, some money. And it is up to the state to tighten up all those areas. You see that the possible areas of leakages are minimized, you know, brought, you know, down to the barest minimum. And that way we can make as many people as possible responsible and want to abide by the laws of the land. And when that happens, then those who even decide not to abide by the laws will deal with them. And so by and large, you'll be creating an enterprising and a prosperous nation which is capable of, you know, addressing the key obligations that it has as a state.
Briefly, Doc, why are some workers so timid to report their employers who fail to pay their contributions? Is it because of fear of retribution?
Yes. There is, you know, so if the system is booming, okay, it's all about the fact that the system is not gelling enough. If the system is booming and we have flexibility and there's mobility, people are free to move and people can easily move or change jobs because they do exist. People will not be reluctant. But if it takes you several years, for instance, to be able to secure a job, people then look at, well, what do I do? If I report, what will be my future in this job? So the key question, the fundamental question, is an issue of job security.
So if there's job security, people will be much more proactive in defending their interests. And that is why I see the action of SNET as a very positive one, so that they will protect the powerless, you know, in society. That is fundamental. And I think that we need to encourage, you know, these institutions to be able to live up to their obligations. And for me, that will be protecting you and I, protecting the citizens of this country, and then, of course, at the end of the day, building a system that we can all trust and will have confidence in. So it is an action that I will fully endorse, and I will urge them to continue to pursue, you know, before this, so that we can guarantee some different retirement for our workers, you know, in future. Yeah.
All right. A very big thank you to you, Doc, for your time with us tonight.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Dr. Evans Azidako is a lecturer in political science at the University of Ghana. It's Behind the News. Let's read some of your text messages. Andrew Manga in Baku says, Ghanaians must unite and move the nation forward. And Isidu Nicholas, University of Education, Winneba says, all Ghanaians should fast on behalf of the Black Stars for God's intervention to let them beat the Egyptians both home and away. Alasan Salifun Sola says, I suppose the incarceration of Mr. George Agude as a result of his failure to pay the SNET contributions of his employees will serve as a deterrent to other private businesses. Fanny Poma Udi in Kapa Alavanyo says, the fishermen at Kapa Botrasi and its environs cannot get permits too well because those in charge are hoarding the fuel, thereby making life unbearable for the fishermen. We are calling on the minister to assist us, and well, we hope the authorities are listening and will investigate to find out the truth. Kojo Akins in Keko says, I personally will have to see Nanado back in the race against energetic and intelligent young President Mahama for a cool chop victory in favor of the NDC in 2016. And Tete Nyankuma Sahinko says, what is the government doing about the 2013 WASI results released by WAEC? It's Behind the News. They're live on Unique FM 95.7. The opening support by some executives and supporters of the NPP for a third bid by Nana Akufo-Addo for the party slot for the next general elections continue to cause a stir within the party. Nana Addo has been receiving commendation for the manner he accepted the Supreme Court election petition verdict. And to his supporters, he stands a better chance of winning the 2016 election if he is retained as the presidential candidate of the party. However, others see the open declaration of support for Nana Addo by some executives of the party as a recipe for division. They contend that such acts can breed mistrust among party executives and compromise their neutrality in the selection of candidates for future elections. Jacob Bichibit Lamte is the chairman of the NPP and is joining us on the line to respond to how the party is dealing with the recent developments within it. Good evening, Mr. Bichibit Lamte, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Agatha. Thank you for having me. And good evening to your listeners.
Good evening. Well, Mr. Bichibit Lamte, some supporters are happy with Nana Addo's reaction to the Supreme Court verdict and are calling on him to state a claim to the party slot for the 2016 elections, while some are also not happy with the call for Nana Addo to be retained in the 2016 elections. How is the party handling this issue?
Well, we're saying that it's human nature. Now, in any given situation, some will want to turn right, some will want to turn left. At the end of the day, the authority on the bus will decide which way the bus goes, whether it goes to the right or it goes to the left. I mean, there's nothing wrong with debating about which way will get us to our destination more quickly.
So how is the party handling? Because to some, this could divide the party.
Well, you know, and 1992, when the party was born, we finally came to a special congress to elect a presidential candidate. I believe on that occasion we had at least six or seven persons vying, and the party ended up not divided, but all behind a group by him. In 1996, it was a very fierce race, and that was had all sorts of different avenues that played off it. But finally, we came to Legon, and out of, again, about seven persons, J.A. Kufuor emerged as the candidate, and the party did not split. In 1998, we had a very fierce encounter between Nana Akufo-Addo and J.A. Kufuor, with others also in the running, and the party chose J.A. Kufuor again, and the party did not split. And indeed, J.A. Kufuor then went on to win the presidency. In 2004, we went to a special congress, and this time J.A. Kufuor had no challenger. And so he went through unchallenged and endorsed by the party, by the electorate. In 2007, we had 17 persons contesting for the presidential slot, and within the party was not split, and so it goes on. Right? This is a party that has championed democracy from its very foundation. That is its whole creation is due to wanting to have a democracy in this country. So if the party cannot itself face the challenges of democratic competition, it has no right advocating that the country should also be governed in a democratic fashion. We're not, certainly the parties are frightened by competition.
But you agree with me that this is an open contest for all in the party. Is it a case for some going left or right, or is it a case for some declaring support for a particular candidate ahead of the opening of nomination? And is this not giving one candidate an advantage over the others?
I tell you that people have been positioning themselves for a very long time. There's in the various competitions. They say that it's the early bird that gets the worm. There are many early birds who have quietly been making contacts here, there, and everywhere to see about how they can rate their chances when the time comes. What we continue to hope in the party is that in any of these contests, people will stick to discussion of the issues, will stick to promoting the virtues of their candidate, whoever they support, and not tear their other candidates apart, especially not tear them apart through lies and falsehoods, which can then be used by our opponents in the larger election to come. But human nature being what it is, and that everybody will look to see what they can use to their advantage if they are ambitious to be in the contest.
Well, but more worse is the fact that those who contest will have to submit their forms to some of the executives who have declared support for Nana Addo.
The party has a way of institutionalized how it conducts its elections. There'll be an electoral committee set up, which is usually under the chairman of the Council of Elders, or maybe somebody else from the Council of Elders, and there are other officers within that, and they are in charge of the actual election process. I don't think there's any national executive or regional executive or constituency executive who can have an overarching say in whether or not a candidate is allowed to contest.
But looking at that situation, does it not compromise the neutrality of the party executives in matters of such nature?
I have my way. I've always advocated it from the time 1997 when I became a regional chairman. But even then, I found it very difficult to control the stances of my executives. people, a lot of people come into politics, they're coming to serve, but they're also ambitious. They also want a position in which to serve. And in seeking that position, they want to ally themselves to the person who they think will emerge as the ultimate winner, and ally themselves early so that they are seen as one of the first stages, as it were, in the hope that, inshallah, the candidate becomes the president of Ghana or the member of parliament for the constituency, and then they will then have some benefit to their ambition from having been associated from the very early stages. It's human nature. We deal with human nature. All we try to do in all of this is to try, while dealing with human nature, to see how best we can make things fair. We can make sure that anybody who is contesting has a completely free access to all the voters, and are allowed to carry their message to the voters, that nobody comes out by executive action. And that's what we're very, very sharp on. We do make sure that people get this access. And then the other thing that we want to do is to make sure that, as much as possible, if we can keep the race clean, that people don't start going out of their way to say things which they know are not true about other candidates.
Well, even though Nanadu himself thinks what is happening within the party is not new, others think if other executives also openly show support for other candidates, the party is likely to disintegrate.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I've been in the party from the very beginning. I have seen many executives, unfortunately, showing open bias, whatever, or open support. But then the party has not disintegrated. The party is not going to disintegrate over this matter either. The MPP is a very strong party. The MPP tradition survives all the years of being in the desert while they continue to contest against the military dictatorship to bring us back into party politics again. We're not going to disintegrate. We are not a party that worships an individual. We're not a party that holds up any individual as being some sort of life icon. Okay, we know that we go and we vote for somebody for this cycle and we vote again for another cycle. Nobody in the MPP, no executive in the MPP is there without having to go through a democratic process. And that includes all our candidates. They go through a democratic process.
And when is the party going to the next Congress elect new leaders?
That was a decision by the National Council. The executives to come up with a draft calendar. Okay, we're working on this. We'll be meeting with them hopefully not too distant future. And then we'll put forward the ideas we have on that calendar. The National Council will debate all the issues, and then we'll finally come out with a statement about how they see what's happening and when they see whatever it is happening.
And is this National Council meeting very close?
It's closer than it is farther away.
All right. And are you going for another term?
I said yes, but I was not clear in my mind until, in fact, about 30 minutes ago, where I met a very learned, very holy man. I want to thank, as part of the thank you tour, and then he counseled me, and as he counseled others who were with me on this tour. I don't know whether he read into me or whatever, but the words that he used, I think definitely, if the party wants me, I will serve.
All right, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Yeah.
Jake Obetebi Lamte is the chairman of the NPP, and Dr. Phil Richardson is a political scientist, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Doc, and welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Well, do you agree with those who think NPP should concern itself with re-strategizing for the next general elections rather than who become the party's leader for the 2016 elections?
Thanks. This is a very... My first observation is that this is a very sensitive issue. NPP has gone through a very long battle. And both issues are important. NPP needs to strategize for the next election. But as part of that strategizing, the person they take to the elections is also very important. And as we may have heard over the last few weeks or days, vitally important is the marketability or sellability of that candidate. So just by way of repeating, yes, both sides of the debate, you know, are possible. I think that at this stage, the debate is a little too early in the day. Nana Akufo-Addo, who is the center of the debate, has is gone out of the country. He's indicated that he wanted to take some time off to reflect, you know, on his own role in politics and the way forward in the future. And I think the party had better, you know, let everything in abeyance, you know, for some time. That, I think, will do the party a lot of good. For those who have been reported to be endorsing Nana Akufo-Addo, such as Mr. Jake Obi-Chibilamte, we must recognize that Jake is the chairman of the party. Not just the chairman of the party, but one of the petitioners, you know, in the last election result challenge in the Supreme Court, which ended a few weeks ago. And he stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder with Nana Akufo-Addo. Assuming the question was put to Jake and he was brought under a lot of pressure to indicate where he stood on the matter, Jake could have, on one hand, as has been argued by some supporters or observers, he could have said that, well, it's not time for the selection or election of the party's presidential candidate. We have a constitution, and at the appropriate time, the party will initiate the processes for the election of the party. So at this time, I have very little to say. That might, and I would say, could have been misinterpreted to mean a disapproval of Nana Akufo-Addo's candidature should Nana show any interest, you know, to contest again for the next election.
Doc, with this open declaration by some party executives, does it compromise that neutrality and may, in effect, threaten the unity of the party as well?
Before I answer that question, let me finish from, you know, where I ended. On the other hand, Jake, you know, having reflected, having known Nana Akufo-Addo as one person who can be very well marketed, having realized his rising glory and high pedigree now, you know, may have felt that he would rather be better off giving Nana Akufo-Addo a ringing endorsement, you know, as the leading candidate, even if others have indicated some interest. So I think that was the dilemma I suspect he must have found himself. And I would suggest or recommend to the members of the party that it compromised the neutrality of those persons. I mean, this is not the first time. It may not be the best, I mean, to put it mildly, you know, as we have had with past experiences. But this is not the first time. And I would caution that even where the party has been able to stand together after very ferocious, you know, election contests, in some instances, it has not reflected well, you know, about the organic unity of the party, and even the kind of message that contest has sent out to the larger or the voting population. For example, in 2008, I wasn't here, so I didn't see much of it. But we all know that 17 people contested, and that gave the leading opponent, NDC, the opportunity, the platform, to call them 17 some damage. Did the party needs convincing people to contest? I don't think so. So, yes, it may tout its democratic traditions. But at the same time, you know, there are some who are arguing that other people in the party are using this democratic credential as a cloak to hide behind the indiscipline within the party, and that lack of temperament to accept seniority or leadership. I suppose Anaku Fado has kept the party well from the little that I've observed. You know, the division within the party can be traced as far back as 1952. Okay? And Anaku Fado has kept the party well from the beginning, 1992. If you go back, the Dubuahin, you know, contested, he won as Jake has was delineated. He contested for only one election. During the formative years of NCP, Edu Bwahin put down 10 million for the purchase of the party's headquarters. He contested once, he got about 31%, and he was upset, and then he lost in 1996. That did not go down well with some sections of NCP supporters. So what I would like to say is that the NCP leadership must recognize that they have an obligation to the large numbers of Ghanaians who have an abiding faith in the party to lead this country,
right,
you know, for whatever, for the achievements of their wishes and aspirations. And they must conduct themselves in such a way as not to disappoint these people.
Right.
So it may be seen to have compromised the neutrality of those who may have declared their support for Nana Akufo-Addo. But I think since it is not new, and since the party believes in the exercise of democratic rights of individuals, and they have this tradition of always coming together, that must be the spirit that should guide the party from now on.
Many thanks for your time with us tonight, Doc. Doc Theo Richardson is a political scientist. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Let's read some of your text messages. And Kyrie Dean, Power Central Grange says, inshallah, Ghana will qualify for Brazil 2014. What we must do is pray for the Black Stars. We should not fear any country. And Akuka Khalidu Mpansi says, even though the probability of the Black Stars making it for the World Cup is high, they need to work hard to beat the Egyptians. And Ben Ahin in Tapa says, Coach Chris Appiah should invite the senior players to beef up the current team. This is the only way the Black Stars can eliminate the Egyptians. Monica Khan says, Mr. Agudi's situation is pathetic, but then I think he deserves it, and we do the right thing when he comes out. And Emmanuel Sowa in Bogapoli says, does government also pay penalty? If yes, where does the money go? SNIT does not credit our contributions promptly, be credited months later. And Bada Kwesi Richard in the Volta region says, the match between Ghana and Egypt is going to be a tough one for Ghana, but I believe we'll see through to Brazil, Kwesi. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Most expected a favorable draw, say, against Senegal or Ethiopia. But no, the Black Stars of Ghana have rather been paired against the Faroes of Egypt for the 2014 FIFA World Cup playoffs. The Stars will have to defeat Egypt if they are to make it to a third consecutive World Cup. The draw results are Cote d'Ivoire versus Senegal, Ethiopia versus Nigeria, Tunisia versus Cameroon, and Burkina Faso versus Algeria. The home and away layoffs matches will be played on the 11th and 18th October for the first leg, and 15th and 19th November for the second leg. In football history, Ghana and Egypt have met 18 times, with Egypt 9 wins, 5 draws and 4 losses. Many have described this pair as a tough nut to crack. Egypt's last game against Ghana was a friendly in January, when the Faroes lost 3-0 ahead of the African Cup of Nations, which they failed to qualify. Will Ghana qualify for the World Cup in Brazil? And how prepared are we to defeat Egypt? Carl Tufor is a football analyst and he joins us on the line. Good evening, Carl, and welcome to the program.
Good evening, madam.
Well, we are certainly in for trouble against the Faroes of Egypt. Do you agree?
Well, I suppose if you say we are in for trouble against Egypt, then the reverse is also applicable. person that is there also in for trouble against Ghana, because I'm not too sure, just as you said about Ghana not being too happy about meeting Egypt. I'm sure the feeling is mutual, and they are not exactly enthused about meeting Ghana. But it is the standout clash, and it is the battle of heavyweights as far as African football is concerned, and whoever wins will certainly have deserved to make it to the World Cup.
Michael, shouldn't we be worried at the prospect of facing an Egyptian side that qualified out of their group with 100% record?
It doesn't matter how you qualify. It only matters that you qualify. And then now this is a simple playoff. So you could have won all your games, and if you go and go and get a massive drop in the first leg and you don't do well to recover in the second leg, then that's it. So the past, the history is totally forgotten about. It's a fresh challenge. It's a new challenge, and you've got to fight yourself up for it.
Well, Ghana is playing at home first, and some view it as a potential disadvantage. Do you also see it that way?
Under normal circumstances, I would have said I would prefer to have Egypt away first, and then you come home to try and make up a really bad deficit. But having said that, I think it's very, very imperative to find out or realize that if you do play the first leg away and you don't get the required result, then playing the return leg at home puts extreme pressure on you to deliver. And you and I know that when you're playing at Kumasi, it has to be not only just winning, but playing the what we call the ice cream football. So there will be much pressure if it were the roles were reversed, that Ghana playing away first and then coming home second. So maybe this, think about it, maybe this is better to have the home leg first, do the business or try to do the business, take home, if it's possible, take home a two-goal advantage. However, it's so key and so vital that the national team does not allow the Egyptians to get an away goal. That in that case, if you do get an away goal, then you are probably in the driving seat.
Well, finally, are we going to Brazil if I should push you to the wall?
I won't say are we going. No, I mean, it's two heavyweights as far as African football is concerned. And you can't just sit down here and say, oh, you're going to qualify. But I'll tell you one thing. There's some funny things that have happened in football. Many Ghanaians wanted Ethiopia. Yes, they wanted Burkina Faso. Yes. Maybe they wanted other nations. Guys, there are no more small boys in football. So you've got Egypt. You've just got to prepare for the job at hand. Make sure you've got the business done or get the business done on the day. And one key advantage for both sides, that's Egypt, is that they basically have nothing doing because of the crisis there. So they don't play any league matches. So it's the case of, well, the team being in camp perpetually. But you can't be in camp forever and just keep on playing what amongst yourself. Then against you, they're not playing competitive matches. Then on in favor of the Black Stars or something positive, at least some of their key players are now playing regularly. The likes of Patrick Ocampo just got into the team. The likes of Sola Andre Ayew. The likes of Kevin Prince Boateng. So that also works in your favor. But what will be determined on the day is what you deliver on that fateful Saturday afternoon, and that's what you have to do.
Carl, I said finally, but let me ask again. Would the players be feeling the pressure of facing a team that is strong and desperate to make it to the World Cup?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because you see, one interesting thing about this Egyptian team is that, yes, they won all their matches, as you said, qualified by a counter with a game or two, you know, with two games to spare. But remember, they failed to qualify for the last African Nations Cup. So that should be a story for you. That should be something to say that they are not unbeatable. So clearly, you put that at the back of your mind. You must focus on that. But having said that, it is going to be two titanic matches, and I just can't wait for it. I suppose the whole of Africa and probably the whole world, when they focus on African football, the World Cup qualifies, will be pointed in that match and any other match that will be taking place at the same time.
Well, I also can't wait for the matches as well. Carl, it's been a pleasure talking to you tonight.
Carl, that's always in mind. God bless you.
Carl Tufour is a football analyst. It's behind the news, and to our last story. Personnel who are posted to the northern part of the country to undertake their national service will no longer have to struggle to get there, as the service secretariat has made it easy for them to get to their destination. To encourage the personnel to accept postings to the hinterlands, the service secretariat today barged the first batch of more than 100 service personnel to the northern part of the country to undertake their national service. So what informed the decision of the secretariat to take it upon itself to transfer the personnel to these areas? Nana Udia Sempa Entry is the Greater Accra Regional Director of the National Service, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Nana, and welcome to the program.
Good evening, and good evening to your listeners.
Well, Nana, what informed this decision to transfer the personnel to their various postings point, particularly to the remotest parts?
Thank you. I agree with me that as a scheme, we also need to motivate the personnel that we post, especially those who accept postings to the northern part of the country. And for this reason, we decided that as a first point, we will help them travel to the northern part of Ghana, and then also to get them some incentives, so that others will learn from this, and maybe from next year, people will not go about seeking for reposting when we have posted them to the northern part of Ghana.
Well, because of lack of time, and let me quickly ask this question. Another perennial problem for personnel have to do with accommodation. How is the scheme helping in that direction?
We are doing our best. For now, we are liaising with user agencies to support personnel who come to their places with accommodation. The scheme is also doing everything possible to put up transit cottages, especially in the regional capitals and some district capitals. We already have some in some districts, but as a scheme, we're going to do more by putting up transit cottages.
All right, Nana, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Nana Udia Sempa Entry is the Greater Accra Regional Director of the National Service Scheme. And let's read some of your text messages. This one is without a name. Please add your names and where you are writing to us from. It says, congratulations, because I always enjoy your program. May God richly bless you. Football is not about the country, but the quality of players on the pitch. Napoleon from Tumutankopade says, person found culpable of mismanaging Jida funds should be prosecuted. And Eric in Marketing says, we qualified for the World Cup under President Kufuor. Likewise, the late Professor Mills is now President Mahama. Many thanks for your text messages. And this is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of the program. Gifty Broom controlled the sounds. And my producers were Edmund Tete, Phyllis Kofi, and Christopher Esidu. Barbara Yakubu read the summaries. My name is Agatha Samuel. Many thanks for staying tuned.